But I think if I hadn't come up with the chip idea, DAB would have failed. Anybody involved in commercial radio in the early 80s, we all had a good time. You better come to the station quick. Graham has been found dead in his car.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Quentin Howard.
We didn't have television until I was 12 years old. So I'm the youngest of five children. We grew up listening to the Home Service, the Light Programme, and some of my strongest childhood memories are listening to the radio, sitting at home on my mum's knee, listen with mother, 1:45, dingy-dong, dingy-dong.
It's 2:45, time for Listen with Mother.
And those embed in your mind, and the thing that always strikes me about radio is you know where you were when you hear that sound again. There's something about the location and the sound that just brings it all back.
"You're a very idle, impertinent little boy," the governess said. "You will write it all out 5 times.
I can remember with my family, we would listen in the dark to a radio series called The Midnight Folk. And so my father would turn all the lights off in the room we were listening to the radio on, and all you could see was the front of the valve radio with the tuning dial glowing, saying Hilversum, Luxembourg, BBC Home Service. And so it was a radio household. And I got interested in the technology behind radio when I was about 8 years old, and I built my first crystal set. I would connect that to a long aerial out the window, and I would listen to all these radio stations coming in. That was formative years for me because that made the connection with radio, and then I got into the electronics of it and built a little amplifier. And my bedside radio when I was 11 years old was a cardboard box with a crystal set and a little battery amplifier in, and the antenna for the crystal radio was a crocodile clip onto the edge of the telephone dial. So that was my radio listening as a child. I became a ballet dancer. And I did that because when I was at school in Bradford in Yorkshire and I was 13 years old, I travelled on the train to school and there were 3 girls who went to the school next door, which was the Braybrooks Dancing Academy. And we got chatting, girls and me, and I quite interested in what they were doing, and they challenged me one day and said, "Why don't you come along and give it a try?" And I did, and I had some aptitude for it. 6 months later, I got awarded a scholarship by Yorkshire Television to go and train with a professional teacher in York. So my Saturdays and my Wednesday afternoons were commuting from Ilkley to York by train, go and dance with his professional teacher, and that was all fine. So I was destined for a Billy Elliot career. And then we moved from Yorkshire down to Wiltshire when I was 15, and there wasn't a professional ballet teacher anywhere in Wiltshire. And then we found one in Exeter. And she was a Royal Academy of Dance regional teacher. There were 6 of them, and she was one of them. And so I would travel down on a Friday night. This is the age of 15. I'd leave school. I went to McFisheries supermarket, stacked shelves for 2 hours, got on a train at Westbury, down to Exeter, stayed in a bed and breakfast with brushed nylon sheets. And then in the morning, I'd walk up the road. I'd go up and do my 5 hours of dance lessons at the dance school, get back on a train, back to Bristol. I'd go ice skating at the Mecca for 2 hours. And then there was a bus, a charabang, that went from the Mecca back to Devizes, got me home at 12:30, and I'd walk home. And that was my weekend, every weekend when I was 15 years old. And it was lovely. It was because it was different. And I enjoyed it immensely. And then when I was 16, I didn't get into the Royal because I got a slight gap between my knees and I'm not the right shape and you have to be cookie cutter the same for them. But I got into the Rombert. I moved to London at the age of 16, living in Clapham. The school was the famous Mercury Theatre, run by Dame Mary Rombert's daughter, in Notting Hill. And I was learning to be a dancer and thoroughly enjoying it. And that was 1973, and that's when Capital Radio came on the air with test transmissions, and I would listen to their test transmissions on my transistor radio and think, "Ooh, this is interesting. What's all this about?"
"We're transmitting on a frequency of 557 kilohertz, 539 metres in the medium wave band. And these special tests are to help us plan independent local radio stations for London."
That was how the radio interest started. And then I moved back home because I wasn't tall enough to be a dancer. So I decided to go into engineering instead, like you do. And I moved back home to Wiltshire, and there was a hospital radio station that opened up at the end of our road, Devizes Hospital Radio. And I went along to have a nose. They had awful equipment. I mean, I cannot tell you how primitive it was.
This is DHBS, the Devizes Hospitals Broadcasting Service.
You're tuned to the Quinton Howard Show on DHBS, the programme that it's worth getting sick for.
They had a six-channel mixer, two Garrard SP25 turntables. There was no slip mats, there was no reverse cue, there was no pre-fade. There was no way of cueing up the records. They just popped the needle down on the record and hoped it landed on the right groove. So the first thing I did was install pre-fade. Now, I don't know how I knew what pre-fade was, because I'd never been in a radio station in my life, but I knew this wasn't right and we could do things better. So I got the engineering of Devizes Hospital Radio better. And then I went off to college, so by now I was in rugby, doing an HND in electronic engineering. I was still interested in radio, and I was still going home at weekends, involved in the hospital radio in Devizes.
Someone knocking at the door, somebody ringing the bell.
1976 comes along, and I'm really interested in radio now. And I wanted to learn how to do something to do with telephone lines for outside broadcasts. And the only people I knew who would know was BRMB. So I cheekily rang up the chief engineer, Dave Wood, at BRMB, and said, "Hello, I'd like to come along and have an anorak visit and learn about this." He said, "Yes, come along." So I was sitting there in his office, October 1976, still a student in my second year, I think, or third year at college. And he said, "So what do you want to know about radio?" And gave me the tour. It was really, really nice. Gave me the time of day, as people did in those days. You know, you were welcomed if you were interested in ILR. While I was chatting to him, somebody knocked on the door, came in the office and said, "Dave, what are we going to do when Mike goes into hospital for 3 months?" Dave said, "I don't know, we'll need a spare engineer for 3 months. Do we know any?" And I put my hand up there and then and said, "I'm free," because I was doing a sandwich course. And so I had 3 months before I resumed my course. He gave me a job there and then. It was fantastic. You had Les Ross, Nicky Steele.
Nicky Steele. Soul Show, far out.
Ed Doolan.
B-R-M-B.
Great commercial production department.
261.
Sales team who were really, really on the ball and were lovely people. A newsroom led by Brian Shepherd and Mike Henfield and Colin Palmer and Maureen Carter and people like that. It was just a fabulous place to be. And in, you know, anybody who worked in ILR in those 70s years, you could do anything because it had not been done before. And everything you did was invented as you went along. And that was the part of the joy of it, because you were pioneering, and importantly, you were not the BBC. There was a bit of an us and them, and there was a friction, certainly, between Dave Wood and the programme director, which was John Russell. There was a friction. But at the operational level, because I became a tech op, that was fine. I was tech opping Tony Butler, and I was tech opping John Russell, who used to do the weekly motoring programme. And it was okay. It was fine. But there was that tension. There was definitely an engineer's us and them. I didn't like that. And I got on well with everybody. So I would go out on outside broadcasts or news broadcasts because I was interested in the content as well. You know, I wanted to be a presenter. I wanted to be on air. And that was never going to happen at BRMB. So I took an interest in the finished product. And possibly lots of engineers don't. Perhaps that's what the problem is. But if you're interested and you know what they're going through and you give them the right kit and you give them the right Q level in the earphones, then they love you and you love them and everybody's happy.
Woo! Now watch it, people think you're enjoying this. Dennis Waterman, it's 6:08, and Les Ross at breakfast time. And to prove that we're terribly mundane, we're going to listen to Sally's washing machine.
So post-BRMB, I got itchy feet. And I applied for the job of chief engineer at Seven Sound, which had just won the licence of the franchise. And that was in June 1979. I was 23. And it was ever so cheeky for a 23-year-old to apply to be a chief engineer. And I didn't think I was going to get it. But they gave me the job. £7,500 a year. Moved to Gloucester. And what was interesting in those days is you had a year to get a station on air. And you had the IBA code of practice to contend with. But the directors at Seven Sound gave me complete freedom. And I'm amazed that they did. So I came along and they said, "Well, you're the chief engineer. Off you go." get the architect sorted out, get the building sorted out, design the studios. Here's the building. We'll come back in 12 months when it's finished. It was almost like that. And I don't know, at that age you have bravado. You're not worried about anything. So you just get on and do it. So I had a budget of £105,000 and I bought Audix desks from Safran Walden. The newsroom, with all the monitoring positions of the newsroom, we made those by hand. We had Ferrograph tape recorders, the Ferrograph Series 7. I couldn't afford Studers, and the Revoxes, the PR99, wasn't really, hadn't been Len Lewis at that time to turn it into a studio machine. So I bought Ferrographs and ITC cart machines, ITC 99s, the brown ones, I had those. And we had a lovely little radio station. It was bijou and compact, but that was a great atmosphere. And that was one of those radio stations that when we came on air, immediately got 60%, 70% reach. You know, everybody in Gloucestershire listened to Seven Sound. It was the biggest thing. The great thing about Seven Sound as well, it was the first radio station I can recall that was properly marketed. Because the man who came in as the first chief executive, a chap called Graham Moon, had been a marketing man in London, and he'd become the chief executive of this radio station. But he launched and marketed it like a tin of beans, and he crafted the PR for that station beautifully. So when we went on air, everybody knew it was coming. All the businesses knew we were coming. He had been out in the previous 9 months and done 350 lunchtime and evening talks in 9 months, speaking to every group there was. Everybody knew we were coming.
Good morning and welcome to the first day on Seven Sound, broadcasting on 388 metres medium wave and 95 VHF FM in stereo.
The launch of the station, I think, was marvellous. I haven't seen a launch of a station since on local radio that, in my mind, matches that for its time and its period. The tragedy was that 9 months later, Graham committed suicide. The sales of the station hadn't been generated, so the board were after him. And there was a moment I can remember vividly, turning up in the morning and seeing him ashen-faced and a whole load of directors milling around the car park at Seven Sound. And I said, "What's happened, Graham?" And he said, "I've just been sacked." I said, "You're joking, why?" And he said, "Well, the sales aren't there, so they want me out, and they've given me till 5 o'clock to resign. What should I do?" And I was off then somewhere for the day going on some other business. And so I didn't hear what happened until somebody rang me in the middle of the night or 4 o'clock in the morning and said, "You better come to the station quick. Graham has been found dead in his car, committed suicide." Couldn't take the rejection. Tragedy. There was a moment in the building, a sort of a 48-hour period, when the staff were rebellious. They were angry. Eddie Vickers had been appointed straight away as the new chief executive, and some people weren't happy with that, and there was a mood of rebellion. But it settled down, and the station went on from strength to strength. But I had fallen out of love with the station, I think, at that point. Not because of that, I just had done. But for me, there was a more interesting thing, which was in Wiltshire, they were starting the licensing process for what became Wiltshire Radio. So I put a consortium together to have a go at this, and we called ourselves Radio Wiltshire, and our application was a good application, actually. It was a bit grandiose. We were going to have two studio centres, one in Chippenham, one in Swindon, and all that kind of palaver and split ads. But we had a good idea behind it, and I had a neat little consortium, but we just weren't powerhouse enough. So we did the IBA interviews, and we had all that going on. And in the end, the group that won it was Wiltshire Radio, headed by Nicholas Tresillian, Henry Meakin. And they won it, and I got to know them in all the meetings that you have, and, you know, we sort of danced around the table at each other a bit. And nothing was happening after they'd been awarded the franchise. So about 2 months later, I rang them up and said, "So what's going on then?" This was October 81. And they said, well, we don't know what to do now. I said, "Well, have you appointed a chief engineer? That's the first thing you need to do. Well, we don't know where to get one. Would you like to come and talk to us?" And I said, "Well, actually, I'm busy at Seven Sound, but I'll consult for you and I'll design your station for you and we'll see where it goes from there." So they gave me a 5 month consultancy at £500 a month to design their station and order the equipment, which I did.
Good morning, this is Wiltshire Radio, serving the Midwest of England, broadcasting on 321 and 258 metres medium wave and stereo VHF. the station with more to say.
There was another tragedy at Severn Sound that happened after I left, and that was two engineers who got electrocuted in the radio car. To this day, I don't know how it happened. I knew one of the engineers, I'd employed him, and he was a very careful engineer. He knew more about health and safety than anybody else on the station. He'd had years of experience, he knew what he was doing. The tragedy happened in that they were doing an outside broadcast from the middle of a field, and they pumped up the mast and it touched 11,000 volt overhead lines. And Tony, the engineer, was killed in the car, and there was a student volunteer engineer who was leaning into the car with his feet on the ground, with his hand on the mast, and he got electrocuted as well, and they were dead. I was called to the health and safety trial that there was for the station and asked to give my evidence, and my evidence was that was exactly as I said there. I don't know how it happened. The only thing that I think was a contributing factor was that at that time Severn Sound was doing about four or five outside broadcasts a day. They would go out on a Sunday and visit every flower show and country show that was going, and that I think was a punishing schedule to ask anybody to do. And when you're in a hurry like that, safety considerations change. Severn Sound was fined £2,500 and found guilty of a health and safety offence. And I think that in itself was insufficient for what had happened. What it did do, though, was it caused every radio station to review their safety practices, and I know that all stations then thought very carefully about it. There was a lot of cavalier practices that were happening at the time, journalists taking radio car out, driving with the mast up, all that kind of stuff. Those practices, by and large, ceased as a result of that tragedy, but it came too late. Wiltshire Radio was interesting to build because we had an old Grade 2 listed country house in Wootton Bassett. The architects, which was Nicholas Grimshaw and Partners, the people who built Stansted Airport and the Waterloo train station extension, so it's all inside-out buildings and metalwork, they were commissioned, not by me, but by the board of directors, to build this monstrosity of a studio complex on the side of this house, which somehow they got planning permission to do. It was a monstrosity because it was complicated, over budget, and functionally far from perfect. But we got there, we got on air. The building was late. I can remember the day we went on air, the newsroom was not in the place where the newsroom ended up because that bit wasn't finished. It was running out of a bathroom in the old building, and we had a board across the bath with a mixer on top, and the audio from IRN was being recorded and put on carts and then given to the journalist to run down to the news booth to read it.
A few moments ago, Britain's 37th independent local radio station opened up for the first time this morning. It's Wiltshire Radio. It's based at Wootton Bassett near Swindon and will be covering Wiltshire and five other surrounding counties with an audience reach of 630,000 people. It will be broadcasting 17 hours a day.
It was hairy stuff. But there's a virtue somehow, a sort of a spirit, a camaraderie that you build in a radio station, in the team, working in those slightly austere circumstances. That actually cemented us together. Ralph was the programme controller at the time. He wasn't the chief exec. A chap called Jerry Zeeler was the chief exec. And he lasted, interestingly, 9 months before he went off to do another job. And Ralph became the MD. And we all had fun. And the nice thing about Wiltshire Radio for me was that Ralph put me on air. I was chief engineer during the week. Saturday mornings, 9 till 12, I did the Top 40 show. And Sundays, 8 till 12... we did the Quen and Glenn radio show, which was a kids' radio show. Both of those shows were fantastic. They were lots of fun to do.
We don't let you on. Secret sound. On we go to 188. Hello.
Hello, Quen and Glenn. Is it somebody open a child safety padlock for?
No, it's not a child safety padlock. OK.
Thanks for calling.
Okay,
853-444-10-5. Hello, Secret Sound.
Quen and Glenn?
Yeah.
Screwing up a brown paper bag.
No, not screwing up a brown paper
Mate.
Bag, mate.
Good boy.
Sorry,
boy.
Up the apples and pears.
Wonder what part of London he comes from.
I don't know. Swimming, I think. Hello.
Quen and Glenn?
Yeah.
Is it somebody putting on a seatbelt?
No. Not putting on a seatbelt. No, it isn't. Sorry.
Sorry, my dear.
Okay, then. Belt up.
Thank you. Hello.
Glenn and I are going out, doing shows on the road, and we're getting 2,000 people turning up to our outside broadcasts. You know, heady times in those early 80s. And anybody involved in commercial radio in the early 80s, we all had a good time because the audience was completely loyal to you. You know, and you just turn up with your radio car, you got a crowd. But I was pushing the engineering of Wiltshire Radio on because I was determined that we'd have the best sounding station, that we'd have the best equipment. So 1984 CDs came along, the first large Sony CD player for studios, massive great machine, and we put those in the studios.
This new long playing record looks very similar to a video disc we've shown you before. The surface is covered by a layer of transparent plastic, so you don't have to worry about grubby fingers or even scratches.
We decided a couple of years later that CDs, which were still early days, they hadn't taken up off as a technology, we were going to make a virtue of CDs at Wiltshire Radio, now called GWR, and we were going to go all CD all day, and we ditched the vinyl. And as a slogan and as a marketing proposition, all CD all day, it hit the moment and hit the mood, and it was terrific. It was an interesting time, a very early example of saying, let's be all digital.
Some radio stations have more crackle than pop. That's why on GWR-FM we play all our music from compact disc. The latest in sound technology harnessed to make certain you get the best all day.
The moment we put computer playout systems in the studio to handle either just the commercials or the music and the commercials, I remember saying to somebody, this is a moment which we're going to have to think about carefully, because up to now, engineers have struggled to give the presenter what they need. Now we've given the presenters and the producers a fantastically flexible tool. My worry is I don't think they'll know how to use it. And I think that's what's happened, is that for quite a long time, the playout machines in the studio weren't used by the presenters as anything other than a replacement for a cart machine. And I think there was a period during the 90s when we kind of lost a lot of stations lost the ability to use that technology to its full potential. And in some cases, we went backwards. And then dreaded networking came in, and then voice tracking and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, what's happened today? Is radio worse than it was? Yeah, it's not what it was when we were young. It's not the same radio. It's moved on. It's different. It's not the radio where 5,000 people turn up an outside broadcast. They're not interested anymore. It's not the radio where you've got 60% share of audience. So we're lucky we lived through those days. They were great days.
And finally, a new independent radio station for Bristol, Bath and the surrounding areas is now on the air. After 20 years of planning, Radio West started broadcasting from its Bristol studios a few moments ago. The station, with a staff of just over 40, will be on the air for 18
years. So 1985, we merged with Radio West. Radio West had been, I think, one of the first of the new wave of 1980s stations, and it had been a failure. They'd had terrible audience figures. Only a 21% reach, figures you'd die for now, but that was a failure in those days, and they never got the revenue together. The management was a bit odd. So we came along and did with the first ever merger of two commercial radio stations. It was a takeover, let's be honest, and ran the stations in Swindon and Bristol with joint programmes, split programmes, some quite complicated engineering to do all that, news bulletins coming from one end or the other. So we produced, I think, quite a technologically sophisticated station using standard technology.
You know all these people who've stayed tuned to this frequency?
Yep, through thick and thin.
What can we do to thank them?
How about giving them radio 24 hours a day?
Hey, yeah, they'd really like that. After all, life goes on 24 hours a day. Why can't radio?
Well, it means we could give them even more of what they want to hear.
What? More local and national news?
Yeah.
And the name change was interesting because Wiltshire Radio had become WR. It had been abbreviated that very quickly. And to keep the identity, all we did was add a G in front of it. And GWR at that time had a big resonance in the West Country because of the railways. So GWR began to grow. We acquired Plymouth Sound, I think, in 1987. And then 210 and 2CR, which by then were also a pair. They'd become a mini group. And we acquired them, I think, in 1988. And we launched on the stock exchange at the same time. So we had some heady days of watching your prices. But we became slaves then to the stock market. And that definitely changed the way that the feel and the look of the radio station internally, us as a management team. because we weren't any more masters of our own destiny. And, you know, in hindsight, would I have done that again? Well, there were good financial reasons for doing it, and some people made a lot of money out of it. But did it help the radio station? If I'm honest, I don't think it did. Radio West. The first thing I did at Radio West was I turned the faders round. I had a little thing that I liked faders to go backwards. I liked the BBC way of doing faders, because that's what we did at BR&B, so that's what I did at Seven Sound, that's what I did at Wiltshire Radio. And the first thing I did at Radio West to stamp our mark on it was to turn the faders around. Little things like that, which annoyed people, but that's what we did, and I was in charge, so I was bloody well going to do it. Classic FM was probably one of the most joyous periods of my engineering and presenting. Because Classic FM was so risky as far as the venture was concerned, we were pioneering again. That's what we did best. There had been a group called Classic FM that had applied for a London licence and not got it. That group had Robin Ray, the really useful group, and a couple of other investors in it. When we got the idea for the national franchises or national licences in 1991, we put together an idea for Classic FM, and that was Michael Butt, Ralph, Eddie Blackwell, who was part of the GWR group, myself, Nicholas Tresillian, who'd been an arts and television mini mogul. And we knew that there was an appetite for classical music. The national stations were highest bidder. So the programme quality and the strengths were secondary, as long as they fitted the category of national stations, which, if you remember, the first FM national station was no rhythmical music of a pop nature or something like that was how it was defined in the House of Lords. So Classic FM fitted that. But we didn't win. The people who won the bid was Colin Mason's group, which was Showtime Radio, and they were going to play show tunes all day. They had 6 weeks to raise their money, and they failed. So we're October 1991. I'm now programme director of the GWR group and chief engineer. I'm out in Florida celebrating the 20th anniversary of Disney World opening with outside broadcasts that we all did back to the UK then. And I got this phone call in the middle of Epcot from Ralph, saying, we've just been rung by the radio authority. They've told us we've got 6 weeks to raise the money. If we can raise it, Classic FM becomes the national station. I need you this afternoon to tell me how much a national transmitter network's going to cost. And I'm in Florida. So I get on the phone, make a few phone calls, and you do what most engineers do. You put your finger in the air and you come up with a figure. And you know, lo and behold, that's what it cost. £5.5 million to build my transmitter network for Classic FM. So that was the starting gun fired in October 91. We then put the consortium together, which was a mixture of that consortium, the original Classic FM consortium, because they had some good connections, and Ralph and his team and the Daily Mail and Time Warner and Peter Michael. And it was tough to get the money together because 1991, there was a recession. There was an advertising recession and nobody wanted to invest in radio, particularly something brand new that nobody had any confidence in and the rest of the industry hated. Because you must remember at that time, the big boys, the Capital Radios, the Piccadillys, the BR&Bs, the Trents, they did not want national radio taking bits of their advertising pie. Now, one of the cleverest things that we did was we ran a trial of Classic FM as a RSL test radio station in six cities across the UK. And we ran a station and we surveyed the listeners, 500 listeners. We ran the station for 3 weeks, during which time we tweaked and changed the format. And the lessons we learnt in those 3 weeks about the presentation style, the type of music, were really valuable lessons. And that allowed us to launch in September 1992 with a station which was fully formed, fully tested, and worked right out of the starting blocks.
Good morning and welcome to Britain's first national commercial radio station. This is Classic FM.
It was the first time anybody had built a national network of transmitters that was not the BBC. And that job fell on my shoulders. My first port of call was to the BBC because we were going to share their antennas. Because the BBC had engineered their national transmitter network for five FM networks. They were confident that at some point they were going to be awarded a fifth network, and the Conservative government pulled the rug from that in about 1988 and announced they weren't going to do that. We were going to share their antennas because the frequencies were cleared only for those sites. They knew that, we knew that. But the BBC were not going to let me share their transmitter halls. It also coincided with the time that the IBA had been disbanded to make the Radio Authority and National Transcommunications, NTL, the transmitter operator. That was now a privatised transmitter operator who I had to go and buy transmission services off. I wasn't allowed to buy them off the BBC. The government blocked me from doing that. So I ended up going to what's now Arqiva, contracting with them for a transmitter network. They wanted to own the transmitters and they wanted to run it as a service. That was too expensive. So I bought the transmitters myself with a loan that we got from a Japanese bank. And that was £5.5 million. We bought the transmitters and then we contracted Arqiva to install them and then operate that as a service. But the BBC never wanted Classic FM to exist. And there were lots of forces working against us. Another one was that they decided that the charge for going on the antenna would be 50% of the total cost of the antenna, even though the BBC had four services on the antenna and we, Classic FM, only had one. Now, logic would say we should pay 20% of the price, but the BBC argued with National Transcommunications that they were one operator, the BBC was another operator, therefore the charges are shared 50-50. And that caused us to get into a spat with the BBC and particularly with National Transcommunications. So here we were, the minnow again, trying to argue for justice. So we took the case to Oftel and I presented to the great and the good Oftel, said this is why it is unfair. And I can remember building a transmitter out of Lego blocks and showing them in coloured Lego blocks why it was unfair that we should pay 50%. Oftel found against us. They found for the BBC and Arqiva, stitched us up. I wasn't going to let that go. No chance. So I fought for the next 3 years to get my money back. And I succeeded in about 1997, after the BBC transmission had been privatised. And I got £3 million back and cut Classic FM's bill by £500,000 a year. And created a precedent which every other person renting a transmitter and sharing antennas has benefited from since, which is the fair share for how many services are on the transmitter. We created a story that we needed this already by the 7th of July 1992. We never said that's when we're going to launch, we just said everything has to be ready by that date. We knew that Radio 3 hated our guts and we knew that the BBC hierarchy were going to do everything they could to damage Classic FM's launch. So part of the subterfuge was to make them believe we were going to launch early. And they swallowed it, hook, line and sinker, because at the beginning of July out came this massive outdoor 48-sheet poster campaign paid for by Radio 3, saying there's a new classical station coming for the common man, and it had a picture of Morris Minor. Classical music for everybody, Radio 3. So they tried to launch a spoiler campaign, but they thought we were going to launch on July the 7th. We, in the meantime, did turn the transmitters on the 7th of July, but we needed to put something on the transmitter as a test transmission. Shall we just play back-to-back classical music? Well, no, because that sets an expectation for what we're going to be. We want to keep our powder dry. And I remember one Saturday afternoon thinking, bloody hell, these things turn on Monday. What am I going to do? Picked up the phone to Michael Bucht and I said, Michael, I've got a daft idea for test transmissions. I've got this tape of Birdsong I made. Can I put that on? Without hesitation, he said, yes, that's the thing to put on. I said, yes, I'm glad you agree, because I think it'll create intrigue. So on Monday morning, the Birdsong started, and it was a 35-minute loop of Birdsong recorded in my back garden a year before for something else, with yours truly doing the transmission announcements, saying, you're listening to a test transmission for Classic FM, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and doing the standard announcement.
This is an engineering test transmission in preparation for the new independent national radio service, Classic FM. Transmissions will be in stereo, and signal polarisation is mixed.
But the press got hold of it. Jonas on Test Match Special, referring to it in a famous bit of broadcast that he did, and he said, I heard this birdsong driving down to the test match today. What's this birdsong doing on the radio? And the Telegraph picked up on that, and it became famous. And then on the 7th of September, on we came with Classic FM.
I'm Nick Bailey, and this is George Frederick Handel.
I recall day one very well, because the night before we nearly didn't get on air. The network of lines that we had were BT temporary circuits connecting our initial set of transmitters up. And I was negotiating a contract with BT for the permanent distribution network to connect all our transmitters up. And BT were playing hardball. The 6th of September, 7 o'clock in the evening, we were still negotiating the contract, when BT said to me, if you don't sign this contract at this new price, which was more than we'd agreed, we're not going to connect up the transmitters tomorrow morning. We'll turn them off because you haven't got a contract. The only tactic I had left was I said, OK, well, if that's your last stance, you'd better watch while I make this phone call. And I, in the boardroom in Classic FM, I picked up the phone and rang ITN. And I said, ITN News Desk, this is Classic FM here. I've got a story for you. BT are holding me hostage and they won't allow me to go on air tomorrow. 5 minutes later, BT signed.
Question five.
Yes.
Let me read it out. You'll find one having a drag outside the walls, or loud changes get you another. Either way, to hell with the French. Why?
Well, I was lying when I said I was going to go for six. I got an idea that this is something...
I was out at the NAB conference in, I think it was Atlanta that year, and I saw the first demonstration of Eureka 147 DAB in its early incarnation. And its early incarnation was a Renault Espace van, absolutely packed to the rafters with equipment, and that was a DAB receiver. There was no spare room in that van. But the vision of what DAB was offering got me there and then, because I could see that DAB meant multi-channel radio, more choice, and the possibility of adding graphics to it. Now, bear in mind, in 1991, before the internet, what were graphics? Nobody really knew, but I knew it had the potential to do more than just audio. And there was something ticking in my head that said, radio probably needs something more than just audio in the future. Otherwise, there's a risk it'll become sidelined. I didn't know any more than that, and it wasn't prophecy. It was just a gut feeling. I got converted there and then, and I became an evangelist for DAB. The turning point was a secret meeting in 1993. You must remember that in the early 90s, commercial radio and the BBC didn't talk to each other. We were not friends at all. I got a call from a chap called Phil Lavin, who was a big cheese in the BBC, and he was driving DAB from the BBC's point of view. And he said, any chance we can have a meeting with you and some of the other chief engineers, directors of technology of the other radio groups? I'd like to talk about DAB. So we had a secret meeting that he was not authorised to come to by the BBC, and we held it in an office in Westbourne Crescent. And we all talked. There was Derek Connolly, there was Peter Jackson, myself, Gray Allen, and Phil Lavin. And he said, look, we want to do DAB. We think you should do DAB. It's not going to work unless commercial radio and the BBC collaborate, and we need to have a common story to take to the government about the frequencies. Are you in? And we all said, yes, we're in. That was the pivotal moment, because it set the groundwork for the whole concept of collaboration between two organisations who, up to that point, with the exception of audience surveys, didn't collaborate on anything. So we lobbied together, the government in 1994, to allocate frequencies, and then we lobbied on the green paper and the white paper for the Broadcasting Act in 1996, the concept of multiplexers, and the whole way that DAB would work. I knew that DAB was absolutely the right thing to do. I knew it was a challenge, and I knew it was going to be difficult, and it was disappointing going to meetings in Europe and hearing other countries trying to get DAB started, but refusing to include the commercial sector. I was fired up. GWR Group was fired up. I'd convinced the board that we should do this. Ralph and I went to dinner in 1997, and I persuaded him there why we, GWR Group, should do digital radio and why we should apply for the National Multiplex license. I said to him, the BBC have one multiplex with all their stations on. You, Ralph, will have the other multiplex, and you will have an equal amount of capacity and Spectrum to the BBC, and for the first time on DAB, the playing field will be levelled, and we will own it. That was it.
The third age of radio arrived today. That's how the BBC described its launch of a new system known as digital audio broadcasting. DAB will offer listeners high-quality sound, free from interference. But the new radios needed to receive the service cost more than £700 each and won't be in the shops for 2 years.
So we set about then putting a franchise group together. We employed KPMG to do a business case for us. We then took that business case round to a lot of possible investors, including receiver manufacturers, Panasonic, Sony. I wanted our multiplex consortium to include the receiver manufacturers, everybody in the food chain. Sony turned us down, Panasonic turned us down. Arkiva, which I think was NTL then, they were in. So the consortium that we ended up with was Virgin Radio, Talk Radio, GWR Group, and National Transcommunications, NTL, now Arkiva. The day before the application went in 1998, for the licence, Virgin fell out of the consortium. And they fell out because they couldn't agree to the terms that we were imposing on them as the lead partner in the consortium, which was you have to invest the same amount of money as your shareholding. They weren't prepared to do that. They wanted to do it all on loan stock. So what they lost as a result of being out of the consortium was that if you were a shareholder in the consortium, you got two radio stations on the multiplex. If you were not a shareholder, but you were the national station, you only had a right to one. So they lost out on that, really, which was a shame, but in the end, it didn't matter.
If we've got assurances that we're going to have a licence on existing transmitters for 10 or 15 years, then I think it's a risk we'd be willing to take. If, as we're currently being told, we may lose that licence in 4 or 5 years, then it's commercial suicide.
The receivers in 1998, the DAB receivers, were pretty crude. Some of the Japanese manufacturers had made prototypes or pre-production prototypes, but they were £1,000 each, or they were hi-fi tuners only. There were some car radios with a lump that went in the boot, which was about the size of Mars. And then there was a Philips radio, which was a cube thing, which was £3,000. That's all there was. But we knew that the progression of technology would mean that this would get cheaper. The only question was when. It was the chicken and egg question. Which do you launch first? Do you launch the services first and then the receivers will follow? Or do you wait for the receivers to come along and launch the services? And the answer was, you have to launch the services first. Nothing really happened until year 2000. So we set off with Digital One, and we had 10 radio stations on the multiplex broadcasting from November 1999, but there were hardly any receivers. And we were marketing and we were doing little promotions and we were doing a lot of B2B on the receiver manufacturers and getting nowhere.
Government, manufacturers and broadcasters have had to go back to the drawing board and adapt the plan because building public interest from scratch has proved harder than expected.
People were beginning to back off DAB. The BBC at the time were thinking of pulling out completely because I think that was the BBC under John Burt. He didn't like DAB. Commercial radio was beginning to get into DAB, but only reluctantly and only because we'd launched and everybody else was doing a Follow Me Act. The Radio Authority beginning to license the local frequencies by then, but nobody really had a plan. It was a bit disjointed and chaotic. The turning point came on a visit that we did together with the BBC to Japan, late 1999. Went to see Sony, Panasonic, JVC, all the big receiver manufacturers. And I went into the Panasonic development labs and they had on the wall 4 DAB chips. Current DAB chip, and it was a board about the size of a piece of A4 paper, stuffed full of components. Then they had another one, another one, another one. And then they had a little tiny chip the size of your fingernail. And that was their Generation 4 chip. And the question I asked the guy, I said, how long will it take you to get to Generation 4? And he said, oh, we could do that now. Really? Yes, why don't you? Well, because the way you make chips is you build this one first, you recoup the R&D money, you spend it on the second generation, you recoup the R&D money through sales, spend it on the third, spend it on the fourth. That will take 7 or 8 years. So I said, the only thing holding you up is money. Yes. OK, and that's when the idea formed in my head that we as the multiplex operator should invest in a chip. So I said to Panasonic, would you be prepared for me to invest in that chip and make the Generation 4 chip straight away? So they scurried off and had a meeting in Japan and came back and said, we like the idea, but we've never done an external investment before. So I'm afraid the answer's no. At the same time that was happening, a company called Videologic had produced a £300 hi-fi receiver. And inside the £300 hi-fi receiver was the Panasonic big board the size of a piece of A4 paper. And I said to them, oh, that's interesting. Why are you doing this? Because that's not your line. You make video cards and you make video graphics for Sega game machines. And the guy, Kevin Dale, who was doing this, was just an audio nut. And he fancied doing it. So pure serendipity. And I struck up a relationship with their chief exec, a chap called Hussein Yassai. He said, oh, yes, that's interesting. Well, we don't know much about DAB chips. And I said, yes, you do. You've just bought a company called Ensigma, who made the first ever DAB chip for Hitachi 3 years ago. He said, I didn't know that. So we tied all the loose ends together and I put the proposition to him and I said, if you made a DAB chip, I want the first £99 radio out of it. So the deal we did was I put £1.5 million in, he put £1.5 million of design effort in, and the second part of the deal was that on the back of that, he would make a consumer radio for £99. And that's what we did. And it took 9 months. The chip worked first time out of the die. We developed in that process the dial that you're so familiar with digital radio, the bar that shows you signal strength, the signal quality, what happens when you tune a station, what happens when a station leaves the multiplex, leaves a question mark behind because you can't see it anymore. All of that was devised by me, the Ensigma company, part of now Imagination Technologies, and Nick Piggott. We sat in a room for 2 days working out what the user interface would be, what the out-of-the-box experience should be for a radio. Those problems were being worked out for the first time because it was the first portable radio. I had this idea that £99 is the magic price point for a radio. At that point, every DAB radio was £300, £500, and it was a hi-fi radio. So we cooked up a promotional idea where we would make some radios using that old Panasonic chipset, but we'd put it into a portable case. And we made 300 of these radios. We then created a marketing campaign using 8 retailers around the country, 8 hi-fi independent retailers, where they would sell these radios. And they'd all start selling them on Friday morning at 9 o'clock on the 11th of December. That was the 100th anniversary of Marconi sending a signal S over the Atlantic. Good day to do it. And we created some marketing and a bit of excitement. And we thought, OK, we're going to see how long it takes to sell out 300 radios at £99. We planned it would take a week. It took 23 minutes. There were queues outside the shop waiting to get in. We knew that was the moment that DAB could work because £99 was the magic price point. That was followed by the Evoke radio, the first £99 radio, the first proper portable DAB radio with our chipset inside it. There's a funny story about the Evoke. Why do you think it's made of wood? So the reason that the Evoke is made of wood is because Imagination Technologies Pure didn't know how many they would order. If you have a radio made on a production line, you need a plastic case, normally. To make the plastic case, you need a die that's going to press the plastic. That die costs £250,000. If you're doing a production run of 5,000 radios, that's quite a high cost per radio to get your money back. If you make the radio casing out of wood, the production cost per radio is lower. So actually, you can afford to hit the £99 price point. That price point was so critical, that's why it only has one speaker in. We couldn't afford to put two speakers in. So everything was engineered down to a price. But what we didn't expect was the Evoke would become so iconic. It became the standard look for a digital radio. And it's now, it's the default image, isn't it?
Pure have always made the best DAB radios.
Oh.
And this one's really exciting. It's the latest version of their Evoke, the Evoke 3. It's got a lot of things you might expect.
There'd been a lot of mistakes made with the early days of digital radio. I think we got it right, by and large, in the UK. The only exception to that, I think we launched too many local multiplexers too fast. We were beginning to do really well. We were beginning to sell radios in volume. The high street retailers were putting them on the shelves. The customers were happy. There was lots of choice of radio stations. So we were a model for how to do DAB. And the only other country that was beginning to come close to that was Norway. Now, it's interesting, talking now in 2016, Norway is about to switch FM off. Next year, there will only be DAB in Norway. So they've overtaken us. Lots of other people vacillated or didn't commit or ran out of money because it was too expensive and there wasn't a return being made. And so they bailed out of DAB, which is a shame. But now, when I look at DAB, there's 34 countries doing it. There's DAB, there's DAB+, which was also the saviour of DAB elsewhere in the world. And it's a big success, certainly compared to any other digital radio system like HD radio, which had been a failure in the States. There was World Space. What happened to that? There's DRM, which is a digital shortwave and medium wave. I regard that as a failure. The only one that succeeded is DAB. Now, people say that it's old-fashioned technology, but actually, it works, it's efficient. There's nothing better to replace it as a broadcast digital radio medium. So now I'm looking after television and technology at the British Forces Broadcasting Service. And I've been here 6 years. We have a worldwide network of radio and TV stations and internet delivery, which serves the most rewarding audience you could ever want as a broadcaster. We've got an audience around the world who appreciate us like nobody else. You get emails, texts, stories back saying, "Thank you, BFBS. You've made my tour of Afghanistan bearable. Thank you for providing our programmes on the ship. We've been on this ship in the South Atlantic for so long, but I can see the football matches. Thank you for doing that." It just makes all the difference. And the lovely thing about BFBS is we don't have shareholders. Every pound we make goes back into making programmes and delivering the radio and the TV to the boys and girls overseas.
Namaste.
Gurkha Radio reflects what the forces are about.
We are dedicated to serve the Gurkhas and their families.
It's a household thing for everyone.
We've got satellites, we've got four satellite footprints that cover about three quarters of the globe. We have to negotiate the rights for all our content that we get from the BBC, ITV, Sky and about 50 other TV channels, and negotiate rights that allow us to broadcast that signal around the world without conflicting with their own rights in other countries that they've sold to other people. So there's a big rights dimension to it. There's a technology dimension because we're getting radio and TV to really difficult places, places where there isn't much infrastructure. It could be what's called a forward operating base, a FOB, which is essentially a foxhole in the middle of a desert somewhere. We'll get TV to those boys and girls there so they can watch the football, keep up with the news, catch up with EastEnders. We'll do that. That's what we've been doing for the last 40 years on television, and that's what we've been doing on radio since 1943. We just know how to do it. What we do now is we productize the transmitters and the television relay systems and the satellite reception systems so that they can be shipped out and self-assembled. Just before I joined BFBS, I met a distant relation who is in the Royal Marines. He had been out in Afghanistan in a place called Shanjin Province, which was a horrible area of the Taliban, and they were shooting at our boys and girls. My distant relation was in the 42 Commando, the Royal Marines. We sent him out a welfare package, my wife and I, because you do that. And the welfare package had, you know, some sweets and goodies in there. And it had a banner in there because it was the World Cup. And the banner said, "Come on, England." And the idea was they'd stick it up in their mess tent above the television and they could all cheer on when England were playing. He sent us an email back saying, "Thanks for the welfare package. Unfortunately, we haven't got a TV because the area we're in is awful. And I can tell you the morale here is terrible because we're being shot at all the time." So I thought no more about it. Until about 4 weeks later, I met up with him for a cup of coffee. He was back on R&R. And I said, "So how did it all go?" And he said, "BFBS, fantastic." "Why?" He said, "Well, we were in that horrible place. The air support wasn't coming through because it was too dangerous. The RAF were being shot out of the sky if they'd attempted to bring a helicopter in. So we, with my colleagues, we'd had 10 casualties, some of them dead. Our morale was rock bottom. We'd run out of bullets, we'd run out of food, we were on rat packs, and to top it all, we had no television. This army helicopter came out of the sky, dropped down, chucked a whole load of stuff out, refreshed our ammunition, refreshed our food, and a bloke jumped out in blue body armour with BFBS on his chest. Under one arm was a television, under the other arm was a satellite dish. The helicopter buggered off, and he came and set up television for us, and we had the World Cup. We were on cloud nine." And the thing that I remember him saying to me, and this underpins everything that BFBS does, he said, That one act by your chap changed the morale of my troop and enabled us to finish our mission. If we hadn't done that, I don't think we'd have got through it alive. Yeah, it's 40 years this year since I started at BRMB, October the 18th, 1976. That was a highlight. You know, your first day walking into a proper radio station. That was just a lovely period.
Welcome back. Sporting music here on BRMB. Johnny Butler's the name and the scores. Well, Birmingham 1, Brighton 1.
Getting my first gig as a chief engineer, big moment. Wiltshire Radio was lovely because Ralph put trust in his people and he put trust in me and gave me a job on air. I mean, I'm a rubbish presenter, but we had a lot of fun. We got an audience and I enjoyed myself. What more can you want? But the two big moments, I think, are Classic FM, because that was big, different and lovely, and not only building the station, but also being a presenter and broadcasting from home and changing that technology and pioneering ISD and stuff. And then the other thing is making DAB a success. I'm cautious about saying this, but I think if I hadn't come up with the chip idea, DAB would have failed. So the chip and pushing the technology and pushing the retailers and the manufacturers was the key to unlocking DAB. And I'm really proud I did that. Disappointments? I wish I'd been good enough to be a proper broadcaster, because that's where the fun and games is.